It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, how does Channel 4 plan to run its own production arm? And how long does the BBC have in its current form? Our panel discuss this and the other top media stories of the week, including when the local radio market fails, can community radio fill the gap? We're in Westminster to find out. All that plus, we look at the plans to move MIB TV from Cannes to London, why The Independent has picked up BuzzFeed, and in the media quiz, we ask, where have all the talent gone? That's all to come in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, it's farewell to Anton Deck's Saturday Night Takeaway. Next Saturday, the primetime duo bow out with an extended two-hour live show on ITV1. But as broadcaster's Chris Curtis said this week, they were off air for 4 years ago, about a decade ago, I think. Will it be back again? It's farewell to One Golden Square as Bauer move out of their home for the past decade to new studios in Euston. The address was previously the home of Virgin 1215 back in 1993, which later became... Anyone? Yes, Absolute Radio. And also, it's a final goodbye to Google Podcasts, which has been switched off in the States, with Alphabet making the switch to YouTube Music as the default on Android phones. Will it work? Probably not, but it'll probably encourage more video podcasts, something which is great news for Google. Well, here we are in full Technicolor on our YouTube channel. I'm at the London Podcast Studios, and my guests are remote thanks to the vagaries of the tube strikes. But here to take us through the other stories of the week... include audio consultant Anne Charles. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
The news seems to be a lot about farewells this week, and we should also probably take a moment to celebrate Paul Chantler, a sort of titan in the radio world who passed this week, which was sad news.
It was incredibly sad. I didn't know Paul well. I'd met him a few times, and like a lot of people, knew him quite well on social media. But there doesn't seem to be a radio group he's not worked for, or a person in the industry who he's not kind of supported in some way. He was co-author of one of the essential media law textbooks that many of us rely on. And I know that several people in industry remarked that he's probably saved the industry thousands and thousands and thousands in not getting in people in legal trouble because they understood what they were doing. And I don't know about you, but my social media feeds were absolutely filled with tributes. And I think we all just need to aspire to be a little bit more like Paul.
Yes, I mean, sometimes radio ends up being a bit of a young person's game. And I think to continue to consistently work kind of throughout your life is pretty impressive. And also, as you touched on there, never one to be fixed in his ideas. You know, radio industry has changed pretty significantly over the last 20 years, but he's always been doing kind of new things or applying kind of older thinking to newer platforms, which was always really valuable. So very sad news this week. And we also welcome to the show, making his debut, is the director of the National Film and Television School, or NFTS. It's Dr. John Wardle. Hi, John.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. It's great to have you here. How good is training generally in the film and TV sector?
Not great. Quite piecemeal. But I think that's what makes the NFTS stand out, really. It's been going for 52 years. We're one of the top film schools in the world. We train more behind the camera roles than any other film and television school in the world. So the only place you can train to be a production accountant, a post-production supervisor, a VFX artist. And we've got a 90% graduate employment rate. And just at the BAFTAs just gone, we run for student work. We won both BAFTAs for short film, short animation and short film. So We do pretty well.
That's nice. And people tend to really like you guys and the work that you do. Is there enough support from the industry for that work?
Oh, you could always have more, but we're very lucky. We're core funded and supported by the BBC, by Channel 4, by ITV, by Prime Video, the Cinema Association. So we're really fortunate for the industry support we have. And they only continue to give that money because they see the benefits of our graduates. So whether it's 9 graduates on one day, the editor, the composer, the post-production supervisor, or the producer of Poor Things, or the sound recordist of The Zone of Interest. If we weren't producing those people, then that money, I think, would soon stop.
Well, I hope you get invited to lots of launch parties if that's the case. Okay, so news this week. Channel 4 has brought in the former boss of Banerjee UK to consult on their new in-house production arm. According to Deadline, Lucinda Hicks will be doing a couple of days a week to prepare for the long-awaited media bill to be passed by Parliament. Something we've talked about on the show quite a bit, what they're going to do with production. This is them making quite a first step, isn't it, John?
Yeah, I was really encouraged by this. I know that indies are really worried about what in-house production at Channel 4 might mean, and I think rightly so. But Lucinda really knows her stuff, you know, whether it was running Dragonfly or senior at Shine and then Banerjee. She's incredibly indie-friendly. She totally understands that world. And so I think it's quite encouraging that Channel 4 have reached out to her to ask her to help them shape what it will be. But the things I've read about her appointment definitely made out that it's a scoping exercise. What shape might this be and how might it work? So I was encouraged that they got her on board.
And it's always tricky, that relationship between indies and broadcasters. And you wouldn't be surprised if some of the indies were a bit nervous with Channel 4's new plans.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been really difficult for indies and for freelancers across the board over the last year or so. There's been freeze of commissioning, not just at Channel 4, but all over the place. And I think one of the problems that I've been seeing more recently is lots of people who are mid-career leaving because they're unable to sustain their careers, and there's not so much training and development. You know, we're talking about getting new people into the industry, but there's not as much career progression for people in the middle. So it's a trying time for lots of people. And when commissioning does start up again, how many people will be left who are actually able to deliver a programme?
I mean, Anne's right, isn't she, John? I mean, it's not been a great time for freelancers in the sector. Is that something students worry about as they're coming into it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think they're all thinking, am I going to get a job at the end of this? I think the thing I always say to them is, if we listen to what the industry was saying about what it needed, we'd be in a real mess, because pre-COVID, I was being told I don't train enough people. During COVID, I was being told I trained too many people. Then after COVID, told I wasn't training enough people again. And then during the strikes and the downturn in commissioning, again, not enough people. The reality is you need slow and steady as she goes. And as Anne said, you need to be supporting mid-career professionals as well. And we run a number of programs in that space where we're supporting people to step up from production coordinator to production manager or assistant production accountant to production accountant. So yeah, I think we need a much longer term view than just what's being commissioned in the next 6 months.
It's going to be interesting for Channel 4 as they kind of work out what they want to be as a production company. And obviously in this scoping exercise, there's lots of different directions they could go. Could acquire a load of indies. They could jump into a particular genre. Do you think they should be adventurous, John, with their thinking, or just try and do something sort of small and steady to get that ball rolling?
Personally, small and steady, and I think build confidence that they're going to do it carefully and thoughtfully. I think the most important thing Channel 4 can do is get back to commissioning great shows from other indies. And hopefully that will happen, you know, soon if it's not already underway. So I think their steps into being an indie themselves is do it slowly, do it thoughtfully, and then you'll take the community with you. I think it's really a dangerous moment for them if they mess that up, because indies will start to look elsewhere, take their best ideas elsewhere. So hopefully, I think, as I said, I think Lucinda's appointment is a really positive step.
I mean, and there's something special about being a public broadcaster, even if you do have a commercial arm. And obviously BBC Studios is becoming more and more a part of what the BBC is and does. But do you think they still need a public service ethos when they're thinking about how they expand their commercial operations? Is it all about the money?
What, for Channel 4? Mm. Well, yes, because the industry shouted very loudly about saving Channel 4. Channel 4 didn't want to become completely part of the private sector and funded in that way. And then for whatever reason, for the last couple of years, Channel 4 hasn't really produced anything that shows why everyone was shouting about saving them. So I think that the distinctiveness point is what Channel 4 is there for, and having a public sector kind of, or public purposes behind that, helps them to be different. And if they're not going to embrace that, and they're not able to make programs or exploit the IP and to have the funding to go forward, then really what is the point? So this, I agree with John, this is a really critical time for Channel 4, and by extension the independent production sector of the UK, because Channel 4 commissions so much stuff normally. And so if its future is the health for a lot of parts of our industry. So, I suppose we just have to wait and see what the plans are going to be.
Well, let's swap ends for public service broadcasting. Now, it says here in the script, while I was sunning myself in the conference halls of LA last week, which I think is producer Matt just feeling annoyed. It wasn't that sunny. It was fine, but it wasn't that sunny. Whilst doing that, Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey, made a speech at the RTS. In it, he trailed the BBC doing AI on our terms, and that moving more revenue away from the licence fee would inevitably shape editorial content that it funds. John, we saw probably the UK's most well-known producer, Richard Osman, take a straw poll of BBC execs. Did you hear that and what he discovered?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Richard and Marina in their kind of unequivocal support for what Tim said. I actually didn't get to go. I was invited, but listened to it online. But weirdly, I felt I'd had a preview of this, because just before Christmas, Tim, Davey and Charlotte Moore invited in a number of their key partners, and he made a similar speech to the one he made last week, where he quoted Jonathan Haidt and he talked about strong institutions, shared stories, social capital. And it was the first, when I was in the room listening to that speech just before Christmas, I remember leaving and thinking, I'm really glad those two are running the BBC. I really feel confident that they get it, that they've got a clear plan for how they're going to do these things, and they're going to make an argument about the license fee that's compelling and really well-reasoned. It doesn't mean they'll get every detail right, because we all make mistakes, but I just feel like they really get what they need to say, and also what the BBC needs to be.
I mean, there's also a feeling that sort of by 2027, which isn't that far away, the BBC would be kind of pretty unrecognisable, or is going to go through a period of quite rapid change. Is that a BBC thing, or is that any media body in 3 years' time is going to look a bit different?
Well, I think it might look different. And obviously, I think your point is the whole sector will change. But I think, strangely, one of the things I really resonated with in what Richard Osman said was that maybe in the 90s and early 2000s, you'd go into the BBC and you'd have conversations with people, and the kind of sense that they were funded by the licence fee and their public purpose was there, but it was absolutely sort of in the background. Now, every conversation is infused with that. And I think whether they're commissioning for iPlayer first and not doing channels in quite the same way or any of that kind of stuff, that's all secondary for me to, do they really understand their public purpose, and is all the key decisions tied to that? And that's what I was excited about in Tim's speech, is I really felt like he was articulating the importance of the BBC for decades to come, not just the next 3 years.
Tim was also keen to showcase sort of the Doctor Who model of working with the commercial sector. And this is sort of getting bigger budgets from Disney and their such like, and to kind of grow BBC brands. Shuri, what's not to like about being bigger and better?
Well, I mean, speaking entirely on behalf of myself as a licence fee payer, and definitely not in any way with any organisations who may be clients, let's get that disclaimer out there. It's a similar issue with Channel 4, isn't it, for all broadcasters? You have your IP, and how are you going to best make use of the things that you've got that you're in this case, license fee payers have already paid for. I thought it was interesting that we're actually starting to get a bit more advocacy again for the concept of a license fee. Because that's been something that I've said before on this programme, that the conversation my entire life has always been the assumption that a license fee is terrible. And rather than looking at, well, actually, maybe a license fee isn't terrible and there might be ways of making it fairer so that you're not necessarily dragging poor people through the court. It's the actual way that the whole model is going to be funded and whether the BBC and the public sector funding is has been in flux for my whole life. And I don't imagine that it being in flux is going to suddenly get sorted out on a magic date in 18 months' time.
Also, John, on that, Labour are likely to be slightly more positive towards the BBC than the current administration.
Yeah, although I think everything I'm hearing from kind of Labour Party missives is that they're going to have no money. And they know they're going to have no money, and therefore they're not going to want to look profligate in their dealings with the BBC. And so I think the licence fee will still be under pressure. I think it's got much more chance of being renewed for the long term under a Labour government. But I think the reality is it won't be pegged to inflation probably in quite the way it was before, and it'll get more challenging. On the Doctor Who point, I think the BBC's really woken up to the fact that when it does those deals, it needs to be really clear about its own originality and attribution. I mean, I know they did some deals around things like Peaky Blinders with Netflix, where if I was to ask my children what is Peaky Blinders on, they would say Netflix. They wouldn't say the BBC. And I think that's increasingly, they're aware of that in a way that, yes, you need co-production money. Yes, you need to make fewer, bigger things, but you also need to make sure people know they came from the BBC, because if you don't, then the license fee becomes under threat. And I think they really get that. And they're being more aggressive in how they do those content deals now.
I don't know if you've seen it, Anne. There's a great article in Bloomberg this week. I think it's the cover story of their magazine about Bluey.
I love Bluey.
Everyone loves Bluey.
I love Bluey.
It's an Australian show made by a guy who'd previously worked on Charlie and Lola for the BBC in the UK and went and basically created an Australian Peppa Pig. ABC funded part of it to get it going, as did a local production company. The BBC then came in after encouraging them and took the international and merchandise rights to it by the BBC Studios funding it. And then it accounts for, and I'm remembering off the top of my head, 34% of Disney Plus's hours consumed. I'm reading all of that, I just thought it was amazing and does show the importance of backing good IP and being in the space. In Australia, there's been a real pushback to the ABC, who kind of had this opportunity but didn't have the money to do it, whereas BBC Studios could go, no, this is one to back. I mean, that's where they've got to make those kind of gambles to decide to be able to return more and more billions of pounds back into the license fee funded BBC.
And we're seeing ever more things moving to BBC Studios so that some of that IP can be exploited internationally, because some of the audio stuff is now moving over to BBC Studios, and that will be interesting because those brands, of as you like, haven't necessarily had as much exploitation in terms of merch or other products as you might expect. Yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens, as always.
With that, are you advocating for more Desert Island Discs merch?
Well, I think there was a suggestion on this show a few months ago about more Archers merch, which I think would go down very, very well, either because people either really love or really hate the Archers. So if they did some merch that reflected both of those opinions, they'd probably be fine.
I saw Clem McGinn, who's a creative director at BBC Studios, and on the audio side, and she was saying it's a good opportunity, having moved public service into studios, to take some ideas that maybe BBC public service doesn't want and kind of punt them out to other channels, other podcasts, or other places, which I thought was a good point. John, are your students, are they thinking about IP? Do they want to be full participants in this new world?
Yeah, absolutely. And we recognise that building relationships between writers, directors, producers at the school is critical to our work. I mean, a good example of that is, Laurie Nunn's How to Have Sex Education, which was created. She, it was an idea she had at the school. She took out, she pitched to Channel 4, it got picked up by Netflix. So we recognise that they need to understand the value that they hold and how it can be exploited. I'm fascinated by your Bluey stat, though. 34% of all viewership on Disney Plus.
Yeah, of the hours consumed.
Amazing.
On now to radio and a rather unsung success story from the past decade, a community radio. Last week, the DCMS hosted an event where people from commercial radio, BBC Local Radio, Ofcom and others came together to discuss the future of the community radio sector in the UK. Trevor Dan chaired the discussions and sent us this report.
Thank you very much, Matt. The Community Radio Symposium has just come to an end, and two of the main organising committee are with me now, Terry Lee from the CMA and Martin Steers from the UK Community Radio Network. Let's just have a quick feeling for how we thought it went.
I really enjoyed the event. We had lots of different people in the audience and lots of interesting conversations, both on stage and you know, when we were having coffee. On stage, I really enjoyed some of the chats that came up around how community radio and podcasting can work in schools and in the education sector. And it struck me, hearing those conversations, you know, just how much of a role community radio can have and potential funds for that sort of work if we can unlock the right sort of government department to fund such things, because we know that community radio is good for like those soft skills or power skills, communication skills, organisation, IT skills, confidence, but resources required to do it. So,
well, it was good to see the minister here, Julia Lopez, yeah. And we had Matt Payton from Radio Centre, we had Ofcom here, we had some big players in the sector, didn't we, Martin?
I was going to say, for me, that's the biggest takeaway, and actually going into this, that's what we wanted to try and do, was have in the room a good mix of community radio people and people from across the broadcasting and wider civic society. You know, we also had the Charity Commission here, we had OmniGov, so, you know, those people were in the room whilst we were having conversations about the benefits and what community radio is and what support it needs, but then also they had an opportunity to talk, and it was really interesting to hear what Matt was saying about, you know, the space to coexist and collaborate between commercial and community radio, conversations with Chris about the opportunities with the BBC. So, I mean, a really good, you know, bringing people together. And actually, you know, you might be able to hear it in the background now. It's the conversations that are equally happening in the breaks and afterwards that I think are as important as the conversations that were happening in the room. Because this, I said it a few times during the event, this was all about starting conversations and starting looking at the future of what community radio is. We're coming up to 20 years old. What's the next 20 years going to look like for community radio?
It was interesting to hear people from the minister to Chris Burns to Ian O'Neill from the DCMS all saying, tell us what you want.
Yes. And maybe we'll ask and we'll get something. You never know. No, I said right at the start of the day that I think everyone in the room knows that things are going to change in the next year in a sort of political level in this country. And that's perhaps when we really need to be ready, community radio, to sort of impress upon our future government why community radio is important. And, you know, Martin was on stage and had a video from Dr. Alison Hume about the research that the UKCRN have done about community radio. And that sort of research, we need to have more of that to sort of sell community radio to all the stakeholders and really prove our worth, because Janie was on talking about the Australian model of community radio and how they have proved their worth, and that's why millions and millions of pounds or dollars are pumped into the Australian community radio system.
Just one final word. I loved the guy at the end who was the angriest delegate I've ever heard at a conference. This has been a very calm event. Nobody's got ruffled at all. And suddenly, a man with a flat cap from Macclesfield went completely spare on the back row. What was all that about?
Without naming the individual, I mean, it just shows the passion there is for community radio. You know, people that have been running these stations for nearly 20 years and have always felt that they needed more help and support. And let's be honest, they're not wrong. They're not wrong. It's about how we get there that matters. You know, the Community Radio Fund hasn't really significantly increased since it was founded. In fact, I think it's gone down in size. It certainly hasn't gone up in value in terms of inflation or the number of stations. You know, when it first launched, it was, you know, £400,000, £500,000 for, I think, 17 or 20 stations. licensed. There are now over 300, I think it's closer to 350 Ofcom licensed community radio stations, AM, FM, DAB, and the fund hasn't moved. So, you know, and there's big talks about regulations, and it's interesting, obviously, the DCMS are just working through their consultation on the changes to analogue. Ofcom today announced that they're looking at, they're consulting on how they regulate community radio through key commitments and the social gain element. And we do need to review the rules and regulations for community radio, because when the new media bill comes in, community radio will be significantly more regulated than commercial radio. So we need to look at how we protect and enshrine the purposes of community radio and its core issues, but also how we can be freed to be able to make the most of community radio and make sure that it's still here in 20 years' time. So it just shows the passion in the room and how, you know, some people, you know, crying out for more support, because actually the more support we get, the more we can do to benefit and impact in our local communities across the country.
Final word from you, Terry.
We referred to conversation with Matt Payton from Radio Centre and Chris Burns from local BBC, and they both said some really interesting things. And chatting with Matt, he's essentially saying we have more in common than divides us these days, community radio and the Radio Centre stations, and that's good in terms of just for community radio going forward, because that was definitely not always the case. And Chris Burns on stage with you, Trevor, talking about how, yeah, there's more that they can do to help community radio stations, more content they can share, and they'll think about it and work on it. So I think there's positive signs.
Terry, thank you. Martin, thank you. This is Trevor Down reporting from Whitehall.
Thanks, Trevor. And community radio is a big support for many parts of the country, especially those that feel left behind by some of the changes to local commercial radio and also recently to BBC local radio. A huge amount of stations doing very different things. It's quite a vibrant sector.
Yes, and I think what you said, huge amount of stations doing a huge amount of different things, is the problem and the joy. So you've got a whole different concept of what community radio can be. In some places it's very tied to a local geographical area, in other places it's tied around a particular community or a particular love of music, and in other places it's people who are enjoying being together, and maybe the music policy is more reflected in what the individual presenter likes. So there's a huge and diverse and disparate nature to community radio. There's some absolutely excellent stuff, and I think its challenge is that money and time, because most of it is run by volunteers. There are some stations who are able to employ a few people, but the amount of revenue that community radio is able to generate at the moment is somewhat limited. And when you are relying primarily on voluntary labour, it can be difficult to ensure long-term consistency in each area. Some places have got large teams of people and really strong setups, and other places are relying on a lot of hard work of a couple of people, and that's very tricky. So it's a hugely disparate sector with a huge opportunity at the moment because of the lack of local options in some places, now that many commercial broadcasters and the BBC have kind of withdrawn or reduced the number of hours that they're producing in local areas.
I think the trick is always around public purposes, because that's part of the reason that community radio, one of the main reasons community radio is there, is to deliver kind of public purposes. And that can be training, doesn't have to be output related, and trying to align that with listeners and servicing listeners, because I think your public purposes are also better served when you have an audience that are enjoying or consuming what you're making.
Yeah, and that's the same for any station, isn't it? If you know why you're there and who your audience is and who your community is that you're building around, then you're going to have a stronger output. But the funding model is still tricky in some places, and it'll be interesting to see if the UK sector, if there's any ability for it to move to a different model. In other parts of the world, community radio or access radio is done quite differently. There are different models in different countries around how things are funded. So I think the sector is becoming much stronger at championing itself, and you've got national bodies like the Community Media Association and the Community Radio Network who are obviously organising these things and talking to DCMS. But it's difficult because obviously each individual station is going to have its own views and opinions and don't necessarily have the time to contribute to a national strategy as well as running a local station. So I suppose there isn't, by definition, there isn't a national, like, here's how community radio is going to work plan, because every community has different needs.
Whilst I think about our own public purposes, we'll take a break and we'll see you in a moment.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
And welcome back. John and Anna here for some more news in brief. More farewells, as after 6 decades, MIP TV in Cannes is coming to an end. The event this month will be the last, as the organiser RX eyes up a new event in London from 2025. John, considering everything we've talked about today, does a move to London make sense?
Well, I think it's a real vote of confidence in the UK. I was chatting to people about it, I don't think everybody fully understands the difference between MIPCOM and MIP TV anyway. So I think the MIP London thing is helpful. It will be held in the Savoy, I think. Is that right? And it'll be adjacent to the London TV screenings. So that's great for UK producers if international buyers continue to attend. But it doesn't sound much cheaper than, you know, to be in the Savoy than it would be to be in the Palais if you're an international buyer. So, it'll be interesting to see what the take-up is internationally. I think it's great for UK producers.
Brits might not be so happy not going to Cannes anymore, but quite a lot of Europe and the rest of the world will quite like to come to London because it's a fun place to do some work and have some fun.
Yes. And I mean, in terms of UK attendance, as much as we like to champion production being made around the country, the vast majority of the industry is in London or in commuting distance to London. So being able to, if you are in the UK and you work in the industry, getting to London is going to be cheaper overall than having to go and have a hotel somewhere else. One of the interesting things, funding for events is difficult. Exhibitors is difficult. You might well find, depending on the kind of exhibitors you've got and where they're based and what equipment they're bringing, it can be quite tricky in a post-Brexit world to get equipment in and out of countries for exhibitions. It's not impossible, but it's more of a headache than it used to be. That's certainly something that we found over the last few years at Radio TechCon. We have some amazing sponsors who are based internationally, and it has been tricky for them sometimes to get equipment in and out of the country. They've persevered, which is why it's great. Thank you very much to them. Organizing events is hard. Industry events, funding in general for things is declining, and there are more events springing up equally, you know, spreading the amount of money that people are available to spend and the budgets that people have free. So I think for a lot of this stuff, it's actually making sure it's in people's calendar and it's one of the events they are definitely going to attend. And so that, I guess, is the gamble here. If it's not working out where they've been before, it's kind of them having the publicity to say, we're in London, it's happening here, get it as part of your routine, get it as part of your budget that you're allowed to be allocated to go on trips to. And then I wish them luck.
It's a crowded marketplace, though, isn't it? With Series Mania, Content London, you know, it's busy out there for buyers, and you know, exhibitors have to decide where they're going to go.
And it's a decision. You can't do everything. You have to pick the ones that work for you. Something else that broke last week was the news that BuzzFeed UK, which also includes HuffPost UK, are going to move all their staff over to The Independent. which is quite when I read this, I knew that BuzzFeed was sort of having a little bit of trouble in America kind of redefining itself as well as economics. But it's, John, it seems quite a deal for the independents to sort of become a kind of millennial digital destination, like super brand.
It really, I might be out of the loop here. I'm not a BuzzFeed reader or a HuffPost reader. And I kind of felt like, well, I wasn't quite sure what was in it for the independent other than taking on the, I mean, they talk a lot about integration and sales channels and marketing channels, but I would have thought that you're just adding a lot of cost and you've got to then think about how you're going to, is the revenue absolutely going to flow? I don't know. Maybe those journalists or those staff, though, it's about 30 staff, I think, moving across, isn't it? Maybe they're just so brilliant and it's the best deal, but it's not a world I fully understand.
Well, The Independent dropped its print edition in 2016, which partly made it profitable. BuzzFeed, no print run, and has sort of lost millions. And is that a marriage maybe that will work? Have The Independent worked out how to monetize their digital content better? So adding more page views from HuffPost and BuzzFeed is a good thing.
Well, I imagine that their accountants have gone through this quite finely to make sure it's going to work. I think it makes sense. Both of those, like Huffington Post has not had the impact it had a few years ago, but for many millennials, it's a brand that they recognise. And so Huffington Post UK, I should say. And so if you have some good journalism at The Independent and you've got BuzzFeed people and Huffington Post people who understand how to actually get traction with that content, then if there'll be more overlap between the brands and the writers and the content and the expertise, I think it could work really well. So, and I'm glad, obviously, that we've got some jobs that look to be secure for the next couple of years at least. So that in a nearly every time we're on this podcast, there's an announcement of some horrendous number of job cuts somewhere. So having some people buying something and investing in it and thinking that it might work out is a glimmer of hope, which is good.
John, like all these outlets sort of have video operations, kind of things like Tasty, I think with BuzzFeed. With your students, obviously you're the sort of television and film school, do they see these places, these digital publishers, as kind of good homes for their talent?
Yeah, I think most students are thinking about, you know, the Netflix high-end television, premium documentary, feature documentary. But increasingly, actually, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've had students who have gone out, struck out on their own, produced branded content for people, work for that. We've got a group of graduates who are basically running the Twitch channels for the NBA. And so I think, you know, it's a work. I always just say, you want to work, guys. So, you know, be adaptable, find where the commissioning budget is. And I think the people who have thrived in the last year, where downturn in commissioning and writer's strikes, have been people who have a foot in other worlds other than traditional broadcast or streaming television. You know, they've got relationships with commercials companies or advertisers who are still spending money.
Okay, just enough time for the media quiz. This week entitled, Where's All the Talent Gone? I'm going to give you the name of a celebrity or a hot media brand. You tell me where they can be found as of this week. So buzz in with your name if you think you know the answer. So Anne, you will say...
Anne.
And John, you will say...
John.
Let's play Where's All the Talent Gone? So where have these people gone? Question number one, Michael Ball.
Anne,
where's old Bawley gone to?
Radio 2 on a Sunday morning.
Yes, so he's moving slots. What's he moving to?
Yeah.
He's moving to Sunday Love Songs, vacated by Steve Wright.
Yes, he is. And for a bonus point, do you know who's going to replace him on his last Sunday show?
Paddy McGuinness.
Yes. Well done. Yes, so Michael Ball off to Radio 2. A good choice, do you think?
Yes.
John, are you a Sunday morning Radio 2 listener?
No.
Will it make you listen?
No, but I have no problem with Michael Ball. I think he'll be very popular.
He will. I'm sure he will. Okay, question number two. Where is Lionsgate's hit show Outlander?
John,
so where's Outlander off to?
Well, Amazon / MGM Plus. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because MGM Plus hasn't launched in the UK, I think. Is that right? It has in other territories, but not here. And I think it comes out later this month. So I think buying that catalogue of work is a really good move, I think. Outland is huge in America, isn't it? Just not here.
Big show. So, yes, so it was on Lionsgate Plus. That closed at the end of Feb. It is getting harder to remember where the shows you like are on, whether or not the whole channel's closed down or not.
I feel like I subscribe to every streaming service, but I don't think I have Lionsgate Plus. So maybe that speaks to where this story came from.
Yeah, so off to Prime Video's MGM Plus channel. MGM Plus, owned by Amazon, and it's sort of what they inherited when they bought MGM, and obviously they're putting that channel on their own channel service.
This feels like an advanced version of the quiz in a few years, like which S4 is owned by whom,
yes,
and when.
Question number three, where is Bluey season 4 going? We've talked about the little chapette earlier.
Is it Disney Plus? Well, it's already there, though, isn't it?
Well, the answer is we don't really know.
Please let it be the BBC.
And there's speculation that it could be the end of Bluey, season 3 finishing up. And the guy behind Bluey has sort of been quite mum on all of this. Does he want to continue it, or has it reached the end? Everybody wants it to continue, especially the BBC, who's pocketed around $2 billion from Bluey, we think. But we will have to wait and see. Disney definitely want to keep it coming.
Seems pretty short-sighted to end it after series 3. I mean, we have a NFGS graduate, Mark Baker, created Peppa Pig, and they're celebrating 20 years this year, and many, many episodes. So I think, you know, you've got 17 years of more episodes to go at least.
Well, reading the article, I think there were some suggestions that could there be a film on the way, or something that maybe gets in the way of another series. Scoring-wise, I think, Anne, you just slightly win there with that bonus extra point. So congratulations to you. You get to work out the media podcasts, public purposes, as well as work out where Bluey's going. If you can tell us next week, that would be great. My thanks to Aaron Charles and John Wardle for joining me today. Anne, where can people keep up with what you're up to?
So I am at annecharles.tv, also on LinkedIn. I am at SparkyRNC on most social media, and I am doing a lot of different things at the moment. I've got some technical projects on the go. I'm sorting out Radio TechCon. I am doing some training things, and most excitingly, I'm doing a lot of work in object-based media, bringing the industry together to agree how we're going to make that all work. It's the future of how we're going to make radio, TV, film, podcasts, make and consume them. So I've got a lot of plans in that area, and they seem to be starting to come together. So,
lovely. AnneCharles.tv. Yeah. And John, where can people see all the stuff that you and the school are doing?
Probably more important and interesting to follow the school rather than me, but NFTS Film TV is our handle on pretty much everything, Instagram, Twitter, all the rest of it. And it's an exciting time for the school because in the budget where they announced the independent tax relief and the support for the National Theatre and the studio project in Sunderland, the government also committed to the expansion of the NFTS. And we've got lots of plans around new course development in areas such as virtual production, real-time animation, the use of generative AI. We've got some apprenticeship work we're doing. So those expansion plans will really motor ahead over the next 12 to 24 months, thanks to the support of the government.
And that's nfts.co.uk. And some interesting stuff about some accessible accommodation as well.
Oh, yeah. So as well as the new course stuff, one of the things we've really worked on over the last few years is making sure the school teaching facilities are fully accessible to disabled students. And what's shocking is in Beaconsfield and High Wycombe, where we're based, as a student, if you're in a wheelchair, you can't live anywhere near the school. You have to live out in Oxford or in London. So we've taking it upon ourselves as part of the expansion plan to build a dozen accessible student rooms, which will mean those students will be able to live on campus and then fully access all the facilities during their time with us. So we're really excited about that.
Great work. Thank you both, and we'll see you all soon.
Thank you.
Thank you all. That's it for today from the Media Podcast. Remember, there's 25% off your first booking at the London Podcast Studios, where we record our show every week. When you use the code MEDIAPOD, just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off with the code MEDIAPOD. And if you're new to the show, make sure you follow it in your favourite app. My name's Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you next week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.